Thank you. All right, we move to the third case of the morning, United States versus Anthony Calabrese, appeal number 08-2861. And we have Ms. Howard.
Good morning, and may I please the court. This appeal is about how far we will allow the impermissible shadow of guilt to be used to convict someone. I'm Sarah Howard. I'm here today representing the defendant and appellate, Anthony Calabrese. In this case, the impermissible shadow of guilt was allowed to be cast too far to give Mr. Calabrese a fair trial. I'm going to address three issues going to that conclusion that there was an impermissible shadow of guilt cast. The fact that the audio tape of a discussion and beating between Mr. Calabrese and a government informant was admitted. The fact that the trials of the three robberies were not severed. And the fact that there was insufficient evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt as to any one of the three robbery charges. Also going to be addressing the fourth issue in this appeal, which is the sentencing issue under the Roberson case from this circuit. First, to talk about the audio tape that was admitted. Again, the audio tape permitted a generalized shadow of guilt to be cast over the trial, which impermissibly influenced the jury. There was an insufficient connection between the audio tape that was admitted to the crimes that were charged. In order for there to be any probative value in using the audio tape, in using the tape discussion between the government informant, Mr. Frank, and Mr. Calabrese, there needed to be something, some conceivable reason that showed a consciousness of guilt for these particular crimes, the Leather Connection robbery, the tattoo parlor robbery, and the Morris Meat robbery. There's nothing like that here. We're certainly not suggesting that Mr. Frank had to artificially mention each robbery or get Mr. Calabrese to talk about the robberies in particular. But we are a long way from that when you read the transcript of the tape.
But Calabrese suspected that Frank was wearing a wire. So is it really surprising that there was no mention to the robberies implicitly or explicitly?
It may or may not be surprising. I don't think I can answer that question, Your Honor, but there needed to be some connection between the crimes for which he was charged, something that would make this probative of consciousness of guilt of these robberies and not consciousness of guilt of just something in general.
But the threats that were made on the tape, doesn't that suggest consciousness of
guilt? It suggests consciousness of guilt at most of something. The government repeatedly suggested that Mr. Calabrese was involved in a number of different illegal activities with these defendants, but there's nothing to connect or tie any of their discussions to any of these particular incidents. And there should be for there to be any probative value. The Sixth Circuit in Copeland said that any lack of specificity linking the statements to the crimes charged permits only a weak inference of any probative value. At most, it was probative that he was perhaps guilty of something, or that he didn't want Mr. Frank talking to the police in general. Perhaps he was afraid what Mr. Frank would say in order for a favorable plea in any of the other crimes with which he was charged. But that doesn't connect the two up such that there's sufficient consciousness of guilt for these particular crimes with which he was charged here in order to make the probative value high enough to present it in light of the type of testimony we're talking about. Besides presenting a sort of generalized he's guilty of something theory and he's a bad person because he engaged in the conduct on the tape, the other issue here is that it's particularly problematic that the tape was used itself and not a transcript. There was absolutely no evidentiary.
Did trial counsel suggest that a transcript be used as opposed to the tape?
There was and in the alternative argument made, but the court denied that, I believe.
So the defense counsel did argue in the alternative to use just a transcript rather than the tape itself.
I believe so, Your Honor, but I can't put my finger right now on that assertion. But there was no evidentiary purpose to hear the sounds that are in the tape, the beating sounds, slugging, anything like that. All of the cases that were cited by the government in support of that argument in their brief, there was a reason for including evidence of a graphic or disturbing nature. The two cases they cited involved evidence of a mangled hand where they had to prove mutilation, or evidence of autopsy wounds where they had to prove the trajectory of the bullets, something that made the graphic nature of the evidence useful. But here there was no reason to do that, again, except to suggest he was guilty of something and to use it as negative character evidence. I'll move on to the failure to sever the trials in this case. And frankly, this issue is fairly closely connected with the our argument that, that there was insufficient evidence to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The failure to sever the trials.
You know, that severance issue.
Yes.
First of all, we have three events in a relatively short period of time, April through September, three robberies. If you tried each of these cases separately, wouldn't a lot of this evidence, you're trying robbery number two, wouldn't evidence of robbery number one and three be admissible, or a lot of it admissible under 404B?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
Because there's no permissible purpose under 404B for which most of the evidence from the other two robberies.
Well, no, it's not to show you're a bad guy, but it can be, you know, we permit that sort of introduction of evidence to show motive or way of operation and things of that sort.
And that's true, Your Honor, but there's such significant differences, or sufficiently significant differences, between the facts of the three robberies that that it would be impossible to show any of the permissible reasons under 404B for most of the evidence at issue between these three robberies. We have, because the three robberies were tried all at once, the jury heard from the victims in all three robberies. Only one of the victims in any of the robberies gave any testimony that could be characterized as a positive identification of Mr. Calabrese. But, and so they certainly wouldn't be allowed to hear from the victim in another robbery of a...
Oh, sure, they could. They could have heard that another robbery occurred, and then hear these witnesses who got the deals, and I understand they got pretty nice deals here to testify. They would have heard all that, I would think.
Well, I would...
At least it's discretionary with the district judge. Rule 404B... admissibility of Rule 404B evidence.
It is discretionary with the trial judge, Your Honor, and I would respectfully suggest that if there had been the consideration about what's fair to be heard as to any one robbery, that a lot of this would have been excluded, for instance, the audio tape. Even where Mr. Frank was not involved, the audio tape was played. It certainly wouldn't have been allowed in the Leather Connection robbery. There would be absolutely no reason under 404B to admit it there. And when you're talking about a parade of felons, of 10 people willing to testify for deals, and give fairly conflicting testimony about who was involved, when they were involved, when a gun was used or wasn't used, at some point it's unreasonable to expect that the sort of pall of guilt that's cast over all three isn't going to infect consideration of guilt as to the three cases by the jury. They certainly wouldn't have been allowed, even presuming, for instance, they would have been allowed to hear from Mrs. Newdell that of her fear during the Leather Connection robbery. And she was brought to testify about, to try and identify Mr. Calabrese. For one thing, she couldn't identify Mr. Calabrese, so it would be of doubtful relevance to any other case to allow her to testify, and we certainly wouldn't allow her to testify about her fear during a robbery involving a defendant in a separate case where she can't even identify him. We wouldn't allow her to say, You know, I testified in this other case where the defendant was charged. I was very afraid. But by the way, I can't identify him. We certainly wouldn't have allowed that for any permissible issue under 404B.
One of the problems I have with your severance argument is the fact that there were so many witnesses from each robbery. So we don't have a situation where testimony hinged on, say, one witness. And so how can you, or what can you point to show that he was unfairly prejudiced from having the case heard by a single jury when there were so many witnesses who implicated him in each of the robberies? And I understand you have problems with credibility of those witnesses, but there were multiple witnesses for each robbery. What's the prejudice?
Well, the prejudice is, first of all, that the victims in all three robberies were heard from at this trial, and the victims have a lot more credibility than any of the felons do. And to hear from all...
Well, but their credibility is that a robbery occurred, not that Mr. Calabrese was involved in... whether he was involved or not depends on whether the jury is going to credit the testimony of these people who got deals to testify.
That's true, Your Honor. Also, the audio tape was heard as all three, and at least as...
Yeah, but the point is, you got the victims and you have co-defendants on each robbery. So, I mean, it's hard for you to make, it seems to me, the prejudice argument, how to show he was prejudiced.
Well, for instance, there was no common alleged accomplices between the Leather Connection robbery and the other two robberies. And the suggestion that perhaps under 404B, some of the other accomplices could have been allowed to testify in the Leather Connection robbery, it's attenuated at best when their testimony is subject to some significant credibility concerns, and it's very it's not at all certain that any other accomplices in the other two robberies would have been allowed to testify in the Leather Connection case.
Yeah, but in the Leather Connection case, didn't just about everybody? Four of them, Cooper, Smith, Bellino, and Baker, testified about it, as well as the victim.
They did testify, Your Honor, but the credibility problems with all of those felons in the Leather Connection case were bolstered by the fact that you then had two other sets of felons in two other cases willing to say, well, he participated in a robbery in these other cases also, and you know, by the way, here's the very frightened victims we have in all three robberies. All of that together, all of those errors together, acted to deny my client a fair trial. If the court has no further questions, I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hammerman.
Morning. May I please the court? The audio tape of the defendant's confrontation with a witness that was cooperating with the government was directly relevant to the evidence in this case. It not only showed the defendant's consciousness of guilt, but it also undermined the defendant's arguments on credibility issues with respect to that cooperating witness. It was probative of the three robberies in this case, not just the two to which the witness was a participant, but the third, because that witness had information and testified about that information as to that third robbery.
Why did the jury have to hear the actual tape? Why wasn't a transcript enough?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I believe that defense counsel is incorrect. That suggestion was never made to the district court. In the motion to exclude the audio tape, there was never an alternative basis suggested. That being said,
After the court admitted that, said it was going to be admitted, did counsel say, well, I stand on my objection, but if it's going to come in, it should just be a transcript?
I'm not aware that suggestion was made, Your Honor.
But didn't defense counsel suggest that maybe the direct testimony of Cooper and Frank about the beating would be enough?
Yes, but, Your Honor,
that's an alternative to the tape itself.
That is an alternative, but the assault itself is not the sole evidence here. There are statements made on that tape by Mr. Calabrese. There are very explicit statements made to the witness about the fact that this witness should not cooperate with law enforcement. The assault was in a sense, to reinforce that point. But Mr. Frank was told, you will forget anything that happened here, and if anybody comes to us, if anything happens to us, those statements could not just be testified to by Mr. Frank and Mr. Cooper. They should be heard coming from the defendant's mouth. That is the individual who said them, and that evidence was – the jury was entitled to that evidence to, in a sense, hear how Mr. Calabrese was trying to silence a witness against him. In addition –
So your position would be that something would have been lost if it had just been the transcript that
Absolutely, the jury – Your Honor. It is one thing to read the cold words on a piece of paper that you should forget what happened here. It's another thing for the jury to be able to hear the emotion in those statements. And there was emotion in those statements as they were conveyed to Mr. Frank. Mr. Frank, it was made clear to him by Mr. Calabrese that he was not to cooperate. And the tone and the manner in which Mr. Calabrese expressed that to Mr. Frank was direct evidence of his consciousness of guilt. And it was direct evidence of the relationship between the two, and that Mr. Calabrese was the one calling the shots here, and that Mr. Calabrese didn't want Mr. Frank talking about him. And because of that, it was directly relevant and it was probative of the charges in this case, and it was properly admitted. In addition, another form of why the audible tape was more important or more appropriate than a transcript. One of the first things that happened when Mr. Frank walked into Mr. Calabrese's office is Mr. Calabrese ordered Mr. Frank to lift up his shirt, because what happened next is that Mr. Calabrese took what was referred to at the trial as a wand. It's something that would detect radio emissions to see if Mr. Frank was wearing a wire. You can hear as the wand goes past Mr. Frank a click, 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 click sound. Now, Mr. Frank can testify about that, but to corroborate his testimony, you can actually hear Mr. Calabrese trying to wand him. And that, once again, is something that would be lost in a transcript, but you can hear in the audio tape, and a further reason that it's relevant and probative. I would also say that in this case, as I said, there was no suggestion that a transcript be used in the alternative. The defendant asked that the audio tape in its entirety be excluded, but the district court used its discretion under Rule 403 and found a median ground that the district court thought was appropriate after listening to the tape. She ordered that certain portions of the audio tape be excluded, namely those portions where Mr. Calabrese threatened Mr. Frank's family, threatened his girlfriend or wife, it was unclear from the record, and those sections where he said he was going to kill Mr. Frank's children, frankly. And that is a proper use of the district court's discretion under Rule 403, and it's not a case in which the district court has abdicated its responsibility. In fact, she exercised it, and that discretion is entitled to deference by this court and should be upheld. The suggestion by defense counsel that there was no connection to these crimes, I just want to address that briefly. I think you're exactly right, Judge Williams, that it would make no sense for Mr. Calabrese, who is so afraid that this individual might be an informant, that he's wanding him and then after the assault strips him absolutely naked to make sure that there is no recording device, is going to start listing the actual crimes that he fears. And it would also make no sense for an informant who has just been violently assaulted to then start to list the crimes that he won't talk to the police about. That is an impossibility. And what the defense counsel is really setting up here is, if an informant or a witness has information about the crimes of the defendant in excess of those charged, and the defendant has, in fact, committed additional crimes, that witness can't testify or information about the defendant's ability or attempts to silence that witness cannot be presented to the jury. That kind of leads to an absurd result that if the witness knows more and the defendant did more, that all evidence be excluded from the jury about the attempts to obstruct justice, the attempts to silence a witness. Here, the fact that Mr. Frank may or may not have known about other crimes should not preclude this probative evidence as to consciousness of guilt and the relationship of the parties. Moving on to the severance issue, there was no actual prejudice in this case by the fact that these three robberies were tried together. The defendant points to no evidence in the record that shows that the jury was somehow swayed simply by the fact that the three robberies were tried together. The defendant has pointed to no evidence in the record that shows that the jury ignored the court's instructions that they consider each one of these counts separately. The fact is the jury is presumed to abide by those instructions, and there is no reason to suggest that they did differently. Moreover, Your Honor is correct that if these cases had been severed, much of the evidence as to any one of the three robberies would have been admissible at the other two. And more importantly, many of these witnesses would have also appeared at a prospective trial of individual robberies. And I'll use as an example the leather connection. Not only did all of Mr. Calabrese's accomplices in that particular robbery testify against him, Mr. Polino, Mr. Baker, Mr. Cooper, and Mr. Smith, but the three accomplices in the meat market robbery also testified against him as to the leather connection robbery, because all three of those witnesses had information about Mr. Calabrese's efforts to store or sell the goods that he stole during the leather connection robbery. Mr. Dawson testified that Mr. Calabrese tried to sell him all of the coats for $6,000. Mr. Sims and Mr. Dawson talked about the fact that they were aware that Mr. Calabrese had stored their coats in a storage locker. It was unclear who had possession of it. It sounds like Mr. Sims and Mr. Dawson actually shared possession of that storage locker. Mr. Frank testified that he took a host of coats out of a vehicle that Mr. Calabrese had possession of and put them into storage bins for him, and that Mr. Calabrese told Mr. Frank that these coats came from, quote, some other job. So all of these witnesses who were part of the meat market robbery would have testified at the leather connection robbery. And the fact is that to establish their relationship to Mr. Calabrese and why Mr. Calabrese would, in a sense, show any side of this first robbery in which he had participated, the leather connection, their relationship with Mr. Calabrese would have been admissible under Rule 404B at a trial of the leather connection. And despite defense counsel's suggestion to the contrary, these robberies were not so distinct and so different. There were similarities in the way that they were executed, such that the evidence of one would have been admitted at the others.
Can you move to the sentencing issue and the Roberson case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel didn't get to it, but I'm concerned about that because Section 3553A says that a sentencing court must impose a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the Act. Doesn't the government's position, as I understand it in your brief, why don't you tell me what your position is? Because I have some concerns about it. Because here the judge thought that the sentence she was imposing was too high, just like the judge did in Roberson.
I wouldn't disagree that the district court suggested that she would have imposed a different sentence if she could consider all of the convictions and a sentence to be imposed for all of the convictions in their entirety. But it's fairly clear that Section 924C requires that the sentence imposed for those gun violations be in addition to any other sentence imposed.
But doesn't your position mean that some sentencing judges are unable to carry out the duty imposed on them under 3553A?
No, Your Honor, because the duty under 3553A still exists with respect to the underlying predicate crime. And in this case, the judge had to look at those factors to determine what an appropriate sentence would have been for the three robberies, which is what she did. And she looked at those factors to determine what sentence was appropriate for that crime, and then abided by the congressional requirement that the Section 924C convictions be added consecutively to that. She followed exactly this court's instruction and rule from the Roberson decision. And nothing has occurred since Roberson that would compel this court to second-guess that decision, let alone overturn it. There has been no compelling reason, which is the requirement, for this court to revisit this issue. There has been no intervening Supreme Court decision that would undermine the court's analysis in that case.
Well, was that analysis really correct? Because the district court in that case knew it had to abide by the mandatory minimums. In Roberson?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
The district court knew that it had to abide by the mandatory minimums in Roberson.
And so did the court here, and she abided by them. She also then looked at those 3553A factors to determine what an appropriate sentence would be for the robberies. And she took into account all of those appropriate factors and came up with a sentence that she believed was appropriate. And she did say if she could look at all of the conduct in its entirety, she might come to a different sentencing determination. But that, if she had, while she might have intended to do so or wanted to do so, there is a congressional directive that the district court judge could not ignore, and that is sentences under 924C are to be consecutive. They're additional sentences. And to lower the sentence for the predicate crime to, in a sense, detract from the overall sentence required by 924C would be to thwart the congressional mandate required by 924C. And that's why she came up with the sentence that she did.
So then the charging, really what it boils down to is how he was charged, right? Because that had a significant impact on the sentence. He could have been charged with the straight robberies and then received some gun enhancements, right?
That could have happened, Your Honor. But
why shouldn't the judge be allowed to consider the sentencing disparities that result from the charging decision?
This court has never... This is actually an issue that comes up a lot in the cases that are cited by both consistent with Roberson and those cited by the defendant, which I would argue are not inconsistent with Roberson. But the fact of the matter is that is a prosecutorial discretion of what charges to bring. And these gun violations, when they are brought, require certain consecutive sentences. And in this case, there were three gun charges that were charged by the grand jury, and the defendant was found guilty of those three gun charges. And Congress has stated that when a defendant is found guilty of those three types of charges, there are mandatory minimum sentences that must be added consecutively, and the district court properly applied those sentences. So, yes, a different guideline range would have existed if no gun charges had been brought, but they were, and that was a matter of prosecutorial discretion, and the penalties to be imposed for that are set by Congress. But more importantly, I think the Roberson analysis that the defendant is asking this court to reconsider, there is nothing that has transpired since that decision that would compel this court to reconsider it. And I would suggest that every court that has considered this, the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, have all come with a very consistent position. Every court that has seen this analysis has adopted the exact same position that this court did in Roberson. And the cases that are cited by the defendant to the contrary are cases in which circuit courts simply affirm district court decisions without actually analyzing this issue. They were instances in which the government did not appeal a sentence where the district court may have lowered the underlying predicate crime sentence because of the 924C counts. In those cases, they simply weren't appealed by the government, and there is no – thus, it's our position that there is no contrary position or decisions out there that are even – would call into question Roberson. And even if some other circuit court were to take a contrary position, that would not be a compelling reason for this court to second-guess its prior decision. I believe my time is up.
Okay.
Ms. Howard, anything further?
Just briefly on the tape, Your Honor, we did ask for the transcript of Malone. I confirm that with trial counsel, and there is no need to hear the sounds. The sounds do not convey a connection between the charges at issue and a consciousness of guilt. The statements were still here, could still be heard by the jury by reading a transcript. There was testimony from both Cooper and Frank about the assault, and there's nothing lost in the transcript when you read the transcript itself. There are some emotion-laden words and phrases. There's no need to hear the actual sound itself to get the meaning, and there's certainly no need to get the sound itself to have the probative value outweigh the extreme unfair prejudice here. There's no need to hear the click, click, click of Mr. Calabrese wanding Mr. Frank in order to tell that the wand was used. Mr. Frank can testify about that. And frankly, I doubt that the average juror would know what the click, click, click meant anyways without being told, which they certainly could have been. This case is extremely similar to the Copeland case from the Sixth Circuit where threats against a prosecutor were kept out all the cases that the government cited showed a strong connection between the threats and the crimes charged. There's no doubt that the standard doesn't have to be that Mr. Frank had to recite all the charges that were made in the indictment, but there does need to be some connection between the tape and the consciousness of guilt theory and the crimes charged. Briefly, just to talk about the severance issue, it's certainly true that we're almost always going to presume that a jury can competently weigh evidence, can follow the judge's instructions, can separate evidence between matters. But at some point, there's never going to be record evidence of the jury's inability to do that. And after examining the conduct of the trial and the evidence that was presented, we have to examine whether it's reasonable to believe a jury could separate the facts and could fairly judge Mr. Calabrese on each crime. I can address this sentencing issue if the court would like me to, but I see my time is up.
If my colleagues would indulge me, I'd like to talk to you about brief writing for just a minute. You are a very vigorous advocate, which we greatly appreciate, and I'm sure our presiding judge will thank you for your accepting appointment on the case. But our Rule 28C talks about not putting argument into the statement of facts, and your statement of facts is very colorful, very graphic. I'll give you an example. On page 10, referring to Cooper's testimony, you say the quality of Cooper's testimony was so poor that no reasonable person could be persuaded by it. In talking about Polino, you say Wally Polino was perhaps the most unreliable witness out of a very bad lot. No reasonable juror could believe that such fundamental fact could be a simple mistake. Very colorful language, the kind of stuff you might read in a Judge Terry Evans opinion. You're commended for your vigorous advocacy, but save it for the argument part and not for the statement of facts.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And as my friend, the very young Judge Tinder, that's a reference to the first case we heard this morning, said that your advocacy has been very good, and we thank you so much for accepting the appointment here, and you have the appreciation of all the judges on the panel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And this case will be taken under advisement.